You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Adam Jacobson. Toku wingawa. Sorry about that, I was using the wrong slider. No mai haere mai ke te wire, mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, welcome to The Wire for Thursday the 29th of June. My name is Adam Jacobson, I will be your host for today. As Jogai is away this week, I think at a job interview. I am joined here in studio by my producers Harry and Ruben. How's it going, Harry?
It's going super good, welcome to Thursday.
Yeah, I know.
It's sending out all the positive vibes to Jogai.
Sending out all the positive vibes. So coming up on the show today, my producer Harry talks to the chairperson of the Mangakiki Tamaki Local Board, Josephine Barlett, on the passing of the new Point England housing bill. Harry chats to Clark Thombson about a new cyber attack which is spreading globally. Producer Ruben McLaren speaks to Adelaide University professor Michael Young and Guy Selman of the Ecological Foundation on the coming global water crisis. And we have our regular chat with Labour leader Andrew Little, who talks to us with the continuing intern saga and the announcement of an employee relations bill. We've got a great show for you lined up today. Remember that you can phone in on 309 3879 with any comments or give us a text on 5395.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Cool. Harry, take it away.
So legislation was passed by the House of Representatives on Tuesday night, allowing for a large-scale housing development on 11.7 hectares of reserve in Tamaki. So this also enables local iwi Ngāti Pawa to build 300 houses on the reserve land as part of its treaty settlement. Auckland Mayor Phil Goff and Chairperson of the Mangakiki Tamaki Local Board, Josephine Bartley, have expressed concern about the government's use of special legislation to lift reserve status outside normal statutory processes. So I had a chat with Bartley on the community's response to the legislation being passed. I began by asking her a little bit about the local board's opinion on the bill.
So, yeah, so our local board opposed the Point England Development Enabling Bill because of the lack of consultation, because of the poor process that was undertaken with this bill, which essentially takes a local reserve and turns it into a housing development, or parts of the reserve into housing development. When you have 20,000 people moving into the area, you need your green space. So, you know, there's just so much concern about the precedent that this bill sets, which is actually now going to be an act, for other areas in Auckland that are facing intensification and looking at parks and reserves in their area.
But if these houses are built on this green space, where is the next nearest green space?
We have quite a lot of green space in Tamaki, but some of the reserves are actually stormwater reserves, so you can't do much on them anyway. They're quite hilly, and they're just there for stormwater. So we're doing an open space network plan, which looks at our parks and reserves in our area and how we can better use them. That plan is now on hold because our plans were to take that plan out and talk to our communities about what they want to see in the parks and reserves. We can't do that now because of the bill, because the bill tells us that we need to put sports fields on the headland, South Point England Reserve, where the dotterels live and other shorebirds, and tells us no grazing, no farming. So the minister's telling Auckland Council and our community what to do in that reserve.
Why has the government not wanted to talk to communities about this? Why are they telling you rather than having a discussion about it?
That's a good question. And I hope you get the chance to ask the minister that, because I'd like to know the answer as well. As a representative of the Tamaki community, you know, it's just common sense and common decency to for the minister and the government to come and talk to our community about something that's happening in our local reserve.
How does it make you feel in terms of the community? Has there been much of a backlash from the community of people speaking up about this?
People have been speaking up about it ever since the bill was put forward over the Christmas holiday, when not a lot of people were in a position to respond or mobilise or find out more information to be able to, you know, to adequately put in a submission on the bill. The local board ran a public meeting to let people know and to, you know, talk to people about what's being proposed. So, you know, the response we've received from the community has been one of shock and disbelief at the actions of the government to do something like this. But at the same time, there is also an understanding of the treaty settlement that's also been tied into the bill. So it's actually caused a lot of tension in our community, which should never have happened.
Why is the treaty settlement causing tension?
Not the treaty settlement. The fact that there's a bill, but that it's being tied to a treaty settlement because people support Ngāti Pāua and their claim. But at the same time, you've got this enabling development bill which circumvents the legislation that's already there to protect the reserve. And so that has been the tension.
What wildlife is at threat?
Well, there'd be quite a lot of wildlife at threat. There's the dotterels. So Sean Lee is one of our community's local volunteers. He's been looking after the dotterels and the other shorebirds down at Point England Reserve, and he's been really vocal, and understandably so, because the dotterels are at risk. There's only 2,000 left of them, and that's where they roost, and that's where that's their habitat, is up on the headlands, and that is where the minister has directed council to put sports fields under this bill.
So is there any plan to move these birds?
So there has been some advice from council environmental experts in this field who have said that you could move them. It's not going to be an easy thing, and it may not work. So there hasn't been any investigation into, you know, looking at shifting them. Not a proper investigation.
Was there anything else you'd like to add, Josephine?
Yeah, I think that this is a... I don't know if anybody else is aware of a situation where the minister has put in place a bill or an act that narrows down into a community and tells the council what to do in one of the local reserves. It just seems... I've never heard of it. I've never heard of government, you know, telling a council or a community what to do in a particular park. Just seems really over the top.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
That was Josephine Bartley of the Mangakiki Tamaki Local Board. Next up, we have another story from producer Harry.
Yes, so Petya, and more recently Not Petya, are ransomware and malicious softwares that are attacking global businesses on grand scales, causing a huge amount of disruption. Many victims have been large companies in Europe and some American businesses, and even one New Zealand business has been hit so far. The virus spreads through networks that use Microsoft Windows, but I wanted to find out what it is, why is it happening, and how can it be stopped or potentially be stopped. I spoke with Auckland University Professor of Computer Science, Clark Tomberson, to find out a little bit more.
It's a variant of Petya, apparently. I'm just working by what I'm reading online. One of the security analyst group called Kaspersky is calling it X-Petya, because it's a significant change from the last bit of ransomware. This one was designed to wipe disk. It was not designed really to to collect ransom. So its target is to destroy, to make servers inoperative, not to hold them up for ransom. So it's really a different sort of a beast. And they modified, as I understand, they modified the previous sort of exploits that were designed for ransomware and turned them into cripplers, basically, that were not giving you any way to get it back.
So what do they have to gain from this if they're not asking for money and they just want to...
Yeah, well, the current theory going around the net, and that seems to have some currency, is this was an attack on the Ukraine. So 60% of the servers hit were in Ukraine, and some of the attack vectors seemed to be pretty specialized for Ukrainian targets, and the rest of the, like ports of Auckland and the like, are maybe collateral damage. That wasn't maybe the intent, although perhaps whoever is doing this is not averse to causing fear and uncertainty and doubt and the like in the rest of the world. But it does seem to be pretty localized to the Ukraine.
So what exactly happened with ports of Auckland?
Oh, I just working from a news report. Apparently they were one of the early victims of all of this, so I'd have to look it up, but I just ran across that. Somebody's newswire said, oh, Ports of Auckland got it. There's been a lot of places taking it, and I don't know how. I think what I heard was, and that may have been just a sideline to the story, that the big shipping line Maersk got hit pretty hard, and when they bring one of their craft into Auckland Harbor and it's not able to do anything because their systems are down, it probably clogs up the whole port. But maybe Auckland Port also had some vulnerable servers, I don't know.
So why do you think Ukraine has been so heavily targeted?
Well, that's now we're in geopolitical speculation, but I mean, it's the usual story of a, I would guess. I mean, what's the usual story? But, there's political unrest. Some group wants to take over a country or take it down. It's a war. So this might be an early case of a full-out sort of cyber attack.
It's quite amazing, really. Just breaking it down, how exactly does it work?
My understanding is what happens is somebody cluelessly opens up an email attachment. There has to be an initial infection getting into the past the defenses that any organization would have. But we have email and Facebook and all sorts of ways to drill through normal security, and somebody brings the payload into an organization that is trying its best to keep the malware out. And when you run an executable on your machine, as may happen whenever you click on something, even on the web you click on it, something's going to run in your machine perhaps, that software may have some side effects. In this case, the side effect might be just to send messages around trying to find the real targets. So to be honest, I don't know the attack, the propagation method. There's a lot of discussion on that in tech circles. But roughly the idea is it's a virus. I mean, but it's crafted by a person. The idea is it has to replicate itself, has to find a host, replicate itself, and eventually... in the case of this one, when it finds the target, if you will, this thing detonates its payload, which is to start attacking the disk.
So where did this all start?
I'm not sure what you mean by who's behind this. Like, where did the? I don't think anybody's got a good theory for which particular group is, or if they have the theory, they're not going to tell the likes of me. Which particular group in the world that might be able to do such things has actually launched that attack. And it may be some unknown group. It's pretty hard to trace the start of this.
Yeah, it's
hard enough with biological. I mean, New Zealand's got a chance because it's an island, right? And you trace a pathogen that's attacking plants to say, oh, it was that. It's usually after the fact, but it was like, oh, it was with that shipment of apples or that shipment of kiwi fruit or something, that shipment of whatever. And it's like, oh, bugger, that insect got into the country or that mold or whatever it is that's attacking you. But in the case of email, my goodness, it's spreads pretty fast. And so to find actually the early, and that's what the forensic analysts are doing feverishly now, I'm sure, trying to trace down what happened in an early case and where did that come from. And once they find the earliest known infection, they can sort of, with forensic crews, you know, looking at network logs and the like, have some clues as to where the how the infection got in there in the first place. And then you might be able to figure out who launched the thing. Because the original launching, they're probably not, they wouldn't have to keep propagating now. There's enough of it around. They can probably propagate itself.
Yeah. Is there any way of protecting yourself against this?
Well, this isn't, in terms of the fear and doubt, it's not targeted at home users. It's pretty easy to patch your home machine. The only people who would be at risk are running maybe a pirated version of Windows, and they haven't patched it because it's a little hard to patch a pirated version. Microsoft puts a little sniffers on, and you try to patch it and say, report you in, or you're afraid that's going to happen. So if you're running licensed software, you're running Linux, you're running a Mac or a PC that's patched, not to worry. It's targeted at servers inside of businesses that are old, like written 10, 20 years ago. They're running old software, and they're all, I don't know what's the metaphor, sort of encrusted in sort of packed away in systems. Sometimes organizations don't even know all the software they're running in various machines. And somewhere in their nest is an old unpatched Windows server that is vulnerable.
So I've seen that Ukraine has been blaming Russia for previous cyber attacks. Is it likely that Russia is behind this picture? I mean, that I've seen that they've denied that this is...
Yeah, well, again, that's the stuff of a political analyst or a diplomat or something. I'm a techie sort of a guy. I could maybe evaluate somebody's tech claims. They traced it to so-and-so, but I still wouldn't be able to tell you whether they were acting on behalf of Russia or somebody else.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, so that will be sorted out in diplomatic means. And the tricky thing here is it's a bit like a terrorist attack in a way an unsourced one. Nobody's come forward to claim responsibility. And often in an attack, you have formal war. That was sort of a big deal. You have to declare war. Let's do this properly, right? And the diplomats get to argue about it for a while before you actually shoot. Certainly not happening here. There wasn't any forewarning that, oh, by the way, if you don't do this, we're going to launch this virus. And even now, days after the attack started, nobody stepped forward to claim this is, we're doing this. It's part of our war. So it's a strange sort of a guerrilla tactic almost, or maybe the better model would be the sort of thing a Secret Service agency would do rather than what a military force would do.
So how could this potentially impact New Zealanders or Zealand companies?
Yeah, again, it's economic problems with, for example, I have heard that the port is certainly worrying about what's going to happen. Again, I don't have detail on it, but when a major pharmaceutical company or a major shipping company is attacked by something like this and has to shut down their systems for a time, that can affect our commerce for sure. And if it sticks around long enough, conceivably even would get some shortages here because we're dependent on a lot of things for imports. And certainly our export markets start to struggle if we can't get the goods out. So, yeah, I mean, we're part of the world economy. So when there's a big attack, then we suffer too.
So I guess for now it's just a waiting game.
Well, and, I don't want to make this seem any bigger than it is. It's certainly big. As far as I know, nobody's died. It's not like they attacked hospitals or flying airplanes or something. It's the worrisome one is that they had to go to a manual system for watching Chernobyl's radiation because their radiation monitors weren't working anymore, or they didn't trust them. They shut them down. So some safety things start to get compromised when you don't have your IT running right. And so things could conceivably escalate from there. But really, I think it's just one of those where you have this horrible thing happening. But to be fair, I'd say it's I'm more bummed by how many people starve each minute than how many companies are losing $1 million a minute. You know what I mean? It's there's nasty things happening in the world all the time. This is one of them. But so far, as far as I know, nobody's dying from it. So it's not like a huge war. It's like an attack.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
That was, where is his name? That was Clark Thombson, Professor of Cybersecurity at Auckland University, speaking to Harry about the recent Petya ransomware attacks. Remember that you can always share your thoughts with us on 309 3879 or give us a text message on 5395. We'll be right back after a little break. Here is Mojo Pin by Jeff Buckley.
Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
It's time to talk politics with Labour leader Andrew Little.
Kia ora, Andrew. This is Adam Herrig.
Hi, Adam.
So today, I thought I'd start off. So this week's headlines have been revolving around the continuing saga of the botched Labour intern scheme, where 85 international students were brought over earlier this year to what some interns had claimed as unsatisfactory conditions. There have been some contradicting statements surrounding this, with Checkpoint last night interviewing a few of the students, saying that there were no problems, yet in other media outlets, in contact with some of the students, they stated that they had to build furniture out of abandoned plastic and things like that. Where do you think these contradicting statements could be coming from, and what's the reason for them?
Well, what I can say is that the party received some, I guess you could call them complaints about some of the conditions where the interns were staying. This was a scheme or a plan that didn't have any authority or approval from the party. It had been raised as an idea very earlier in the year, but it wasn't one that the party wished to be a part of or wished to pick up, and it was a surprise to many of us that there was even this whole intern scheme going on. Once we got the complaints, we made the decision, this had been done in the name of the Labor Party, we had to step in, we take responsibility, we investigated the complaints that we had. At least a couple of the interns who were there at the time were concerned about things, but the Party General Secretary, Andrew Curtin, and his staff interviewed and met with every one of the students and basically gave them the option to continue on the program, in which case we would find, you know, different accommodation and actually put together a program that met their expectations, or to go home. Some have gone home. I think the two of the people have gone, people who had raised the complaints initially. Most of the interns have, and they expressed a desire to stay, and they are staying, and we're finding alternative accommodation for them, and we're putting together a program for them. So, I mean, I don't want to criticise anybody for raising issues of concern to them, because they clearly did that, but it may well be that the concerns of two or three or maybe a small group were taken and got a perspective or a proportion that actually wasn't consistent with the way most of the interns were feeling and the way they felt about the program. So that's the only explanation I can come up with.
Okay. You also stated how you had very little idea about the operations of Matt McCartan, but wasn't he under you as a staff member at the time? Did he not raise any of the prospects of starting this internship with you?
No, he was the director of my Auckland office, for sure. And so I was seeing Matt on a regular basis. I'm in Auckland every week, and he was there to organise my program. Although he raised this as an idea at the beginning of the year, and I had said, look, it's not a matter that my office can be concerned with. It's a party matter. It's about the campaign and internships and what have you. It's a party matter. And I wasn't involved, had no involvement or knowledge of it after that. Now, although Matt was employed by me up until May this year, you know, he is free to do his own things in his own time, and I'm assured that his involvement in it was in his own time. He wasn't the only one actively involved in putting it together. There were others as well. In fact, at least three other people on the party side who were involved in it. So that's how it sort of came together. But I had no knowledge of what was happening, and until we got the complaints, had no knowledge of the size and scale of it and what was actually going on.
Right, because it's also come out this week that one of those members who were a part of it has resigned, Paul Chalmers. Why do you think he offered his resignation up?
Well, he stood down from the governing council of the party, and because he was associated with it, he was involved in it, and because the party is going to have an investigation into how things got to the point that they did without the party giving approval or giving authority or being involved. And it is right that he should stand aside, and he's done that, and the party now has to do its inquiry and you know, to get to the bottom of the matter and get the facts about how it actually happened in the way that it did.
So could his resignation be seen as almost a way to save a little bit of face for the Labor Party?
Well, he volunteered to stand down from the governing council, and he's done that, and he has said he will stand down until there is a completed inquiry and, you know, conclusions are known. So he made that decision himself. I happen to think it was the right thing because he did have an involvement in the whole thing.
Right, right. It's also been confirmed that two of the students were here on incorrect visas. Why had this not been thoroughly checked upon arrival?
Well, that's again a question I can't answer because I wasn't involved, my office wasn't involved, and the party wasn't involved. It goes back to that whole thing that had this been something that had actually been, you know, properly organised through the party and sought the proper approvals, then proper management arrangements could have been put in relation to it. But that didn't happen. So the people involved in putting it together, they have organised it, and obviously of the 85 who've come here, two didn't have the right visa. I have to say, in fairness to them, I've seen a document that did say that those who were coming here were required to themselves arrange their own working holiday visa, and two of them didn't. So that's what's happened. So that's what we've discovered since the party headquarters has taken over and taken control.
Right, right. And then also coming up today, just moving on to our next topic, Labor will be announcing shortly their employment relations policy at 12:30. Can you break down this policy for me?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the big motivation is the fact that for far too many New Zealanders now, their wages are simply not keeping pace with the real cost of living. I've met workers who have gone 6 or 7 years without a pay increase. We know that last year alone, of those who got a pay increase, roughly two-thirds or three-quarters, the pay increase they received didn't keep pace with the rate of inflation. And then if you add on top of that, the fact that rents and housing costs are just going through the roof. There is something seriously wrong when we have an economy that's growing, and the government tells us one of the fastest rates of growth in the world, but the gains clearly are not being shared properly. And the one way you share economic gains is through decent wages. So we will have some commitments about wages and wage setting and improving the rules around collective bargaining to make sure that we keep that upward pressure on wages. We are going to replace the 90-day fire-at-will law that National introduced for trial periods. Look, we'll continue to ensure that employers are entitled to take workers on a trial period, but the rules of fairness that the National Party eliminated when they introduced their law in 2009, we're going to put those rules of fairness back. There's a range of other things. But in the end, it comes down to having a set of employment laws that treat people fairly, make sure that workers are getting their fair share in terms of decent pay and conditions, but actually also encourage an environment in the workplace where workers have a voice, have a say on the business that they are part of, and increase productivity that way, and that everybody gets to benefit from. So it is about saying, you know, the employment relationship is a mutual relationship. It's not one where the boss just gets to crack the whip and that's it. It's got to be a genuinely collaborative, cooperative, mutual relationship.
Right. So essentially it's about regaining some sense of equality towards worker wages then?
Equality, fairness. I mean, the idea, it was great to see the aged care and home care workers getting their settlement a few weeks ago. The government got them behind. In the end, the government had to get them behind it because those workers had gone to court four times get that result, and the government was told, basically, you hop on board or we'll tell you what you're going to pay these workers, and then the government sort of got down to negotiate. You shouldn't have to spend 4 years going to the highest court in the land to get justice and to get decent pay. So we want to change that attitude and that culture, put in place mechanisms that mean that people can get decent and fair pay just through, you know, proper dialogue and conversation. The other thing we want to do is, you know, for a lot of workers who are employed as ostensibly as contractors, but actually where there's a high degree of control over the person they're contracted to, actually they should have some rights too to negotiate their pay and their conditions and not be subject to summary termination of the contract. So it is a different approach. It's about recognising that we've got to do something better in terms of incomes and pay. We've just got to do better, and this is what our law changes are geared to doing.
Right. Thank you very much for joining me again this week, Andrew.
Thanks, Adam.
See you later.
You've been listening to Andrew Little from the Labour Party.
The Wire.
Yes, that was Andrew Little for his weekly talk with us. Now we'll be having that break that I mentioned before. We just had a little bit of a desk malfunction.
Thank you. opinion down my back, give me more. Well, it's you I've waited my life to see. It's you I've searched so hard for. Don't wanna weep for you, don't wanna know. I'm blind and tortured, the white horse is full. The memory is far, the rhythm's far slow. Black beauty, I love your song. Sir, black beauty.
I had a good old time. Sawmill Brewery presents Madcap Madness 2017, Saturday, July 1st across Whammy, Backroom and Wine Cellar, an intimate and inclusive boutique music festival all in K Road St. Kevin's Arcade. Focused on celebrating New Zealand's local talent, Madcap Madness features Go Tanks, Montel 299, Peach Milk, Razor Beezer, Soccer Practice and many more. Capacity is only 400, so get in fast. For tickets, information and the full lineup, go to undertheradar.co.nz.
Alright mate, yeah, not bad. Hey, come check out some of these beautiful tracks. I got 96kb MP3s, I got the sick WMA from Zippy Share, some great YouTube rips, some ultra weird Nigerian boogie. Check this. Just listen.
Oh, no, I don't think so.
No, you're the boss. Hey, how about this? Come on and wind me up.
The Swap Meet. 4 till 7 every Sunday afternoon on BFM. It's a digger's selection of funk, soul, boogie, jazz and whatever else is in the bag that week. With your hosts, Jupt, Kirk, Ira and guests.
Lay back, take it easy.
I saw this girl in a black Mercedes.
The Swap Meet, Sundays from 4 p.m. on 95 BFM.
Irirangi Po, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Yes, welcome back to The Wire for your Thursday. You just listened to Mojo Pin by Jeff Buckley. Now, coming up on the show, we have a report by Ruben. Take it away, Ruben.
In light of new research this month, the United Nations Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has warned that by 2050, the global demand for fresh water is expected to grow by more than 40%. And at least a quarter of the world's population will live in countries with chronic or recurrent lack of clean water. I spoke to Professor Michael Young of Adelaide University about global water shortages and their effects.
Essentially what's happening around the world is populations grow and people move, particularly from rural areas into urban areas, and become wealthier. They all want access to more and more water. And the amount of water around the world is either stable and quite a few areas has been overused and is being depleted. So whether you're in Africa, the United States where I am at the moment, Australia or even in New Zealand, more and more people are becoming exposed to water scarcity, and by the middle of this century it's expected that well over half of the population of the world will be living in an environment where access to water is either scarce or they're going to be very dependent on very expensive desalination as a source.
What countries might be worst affected?
I think that's almost the wrong way to ask the question. Global studies show that we can live within the world's limited water resources, but what we need everywhere are robust sharing schemes. Essentially, when a resource is scarce, whether it be the climate, water or fish, you have to have some sort of sharing scheme where there's a process in place that if somebody wants to use more water and they want a bigger share of the available resource, someone else has to agree to take a lesser share. And once you put those sorts of regimes in place, you drive the efficiencies that are necessary for us all to have access. And so the challenge really everywhere, and the question is not so much which countries are going to be worst off, but which countries have the courage and the discipline to put in place robust water sharing regimes. That's the solution. I'm here in California at the moment, looking at how to share access to groundwater resources, which have been dropping meter by meter every year, and there's serious subsidence occurring. I can show you similar problems in India and even in New Zealand, which has a fairly wet climate. There are parts of New Zealand where now the limits have been reached, sometimes in water quality, but also in water quantity. And as those emerge, the challenge is to move to a sharing regime that forces everybody to plan to look after water resources.
Could this be an international sharing regime in which water is transported from, say, a country with more than enough to a country that doesn't have enough?
No, that will never happen, because water is very, very heavy, and in fact is the cheapest thing per ton that you bring into your house. It comes in via a tap, and it's so heavy, and the amounts that are needed, that it's much more efficient to either move the people and also to do things like grow food elsewhere and bring the food to you rather than bring the water to you. You know, you think of a bottle of wine, there are hundreds of bottles of water used. In fact, it's about 300 bottles of water used to make one bottle of wine. It's much easier to go to places where water is abundant, grow the grapes there, convert it into wine, and then bring the wine to New Zealand, rather than to bring a truck or a ship to bring the water over, then put it in a truck and then bring it to wherever it's needed. So scarcity means we just have to manage well.
So how is water scarcity and climate change interrelated?
That's actually a really interesting question. Many people get to me or talk to me and are very, very concerned about climate change and water. What that does mean is supplies will change. But on the scale of the changes that are occurring around the world, climate change actually isn't the biggest factor driving changes in demand for water or in where scarcities are moving. Other factors like population change, growing industry, growing wealth, and changing demands for water and water-based products are giving much larger shocks than climate change. Climate change occurs fairly slowly and is easily adjusted for, while variability has to be managed, and changes in variability are important. The real challenge is just to build a system that can cope with working within whatever the limit is and doing well. Australia in the first half of, in the first decade of this century, had a massive drought. In fact, it coped quite well. In fact, the rest of the world has been very impressed with how well Australia coped, because in essence it had a robust water sharing system in place. If the same drought had happened in New Zealand over a decade or happened in America, it would have been an absolute crisis, because the country's structures used to manage water weren't in place and still aren't in place.
I spoke to Guy Salmon, the Executive Director of New Zealand's Ecologic Foundation, and asked him about New Zealand's freshwater resources.
The kind of pattern that we're getting around the world is in a sense exemplified in New Zealand, which is that on western sides of the islands you're getting it's getting wetter with more high intensity rainfall, and on the eastern sides of the islands it's getting drier and more desert-like, longer droughts in summer. And so if you sort of expand that pattern to the world, the little part which is still kind of moderate and temperate and good for growing food is getting smaller.
So possible food shortages in New Zealand as a consequence?
I don't think we'll have food shortages in terms of feeding our own people, because 90% of the food we grow is exported. So the problem for us, I think, is going to be the long-term future outlook for our economy. And we're facing that dilemma anyway, because the way we grow a lot of our food, or particularly livestock and dairy, is causing a lot of water contamination problems, which as well as greenhouse gas emissions. So if we're going to reverse those trends, we already face a challenge to diversify our economy. It's something we haven't proved to be very good at so far, but it's certainly the need for diversifying our economy is going to grow over time.
So how might we combat the issue in New Zealand?
Well, there's a role for a number of different strategies here. Obviously, one which the farming community is very keen on is building more water storage so that we can irrigate dry areas. And that's not just important from the farming community's point of view as well. If you're an environmentalist like I am and you're thinking about how's the country going to manage climate change, there's a key strategy, I think, is to become less dependent on livestock as a means of land use and move more into growing forests on hill country and growing horticultural crops on the easier country, the lowlands. And if you do that, then the first thing that's going to happen is you plant more trees in dry areas, the streams are not going to have so much water coming down them. And secondly, the horticulture crops that you're wanting to grow are going to need reliable water, because if they go through a prolonged drought, the trees just die. So we're going to need some water storage from the point of view of tackling climate change and having our agriculture less dependent on livestock. If you think about livestock, it's kind of an ideal thing to grow if you haven't got reliable summer rainfall. But if you could organise water storage and you could store water during those drought periods, then you could grow horticultural crops. And you know, horticulture has grown by 22% in the last 12 months. So just over the last year, it's been a 22% growth. That's enormous.
So considering the vast amount of water it takes to produce meat, should we instead be moving from meat production into more vegetative?
I think that's the basic idea here. Half our greenhouse gas emissions are coming from livestock production. If we were going to find, I mean, there are some things you can do to reduce the emissions from livestock, but even if you do all those things, you still have to reduce our livestock numbers by at least a third by the middle of the century. So that means a combination of forestry and horticulture, and in order for that to make sense, we also have to have water storage.
So do you think the New Zealand government should be doing more to safeguard fresh water resources?
Obviously it should. There's been a big issue recently about swimmability, and it's pretty obvious, I think, to everyone now that New Zealanders feel passionate about being able to swim in streams and lakes. And the fact that that ability has been lost in many places over recent years is a pretty tragic story, and something which we've got to turn around. So it's really exciting, I think, to be coming up to an election in which the major parties are finally making an issue of this and promising to do something about it.
What is your stance on the National Party's policy regarding swimmable waters?
I think they've got a rather leisurely approach to the problem. So they're talking about getting 90% of the main freshwater bodies up to a swimmability standard by 2040. And I think the obvious question most people are going to ask is, why couldn't we do it a lot sooner than that? And part of the answer is cost. I mean, there's quite a few small rural towns that aren't going to find it easy to spend money on upgrading their sewage infrastructure. But there ought to be more money available from central government to help those small towns, I think. And with the farming community, you know, I think they're starting to show a willingness to move a bit faster on some of these issues as well. So we need a bit more leadership in this space than we're getting at the moment.
Well, the World Bank forecasts that water availability in cities could decline by as much as two-thirds by 2050. What is the current situation in New Zealand regarding freshwater availability?
We're okay in a lot of places, but you think about Auckland. I mean, this is our fastest growing and biggest city. It's piping water up from the Waikato River. The people who live in the Waikato are pretty nervous about whether they're going to have enough water supplies for irrigating crops and farms in the Waikato when Auckland's growth means that they're going to be wanting to take more water from the Waikato. So we've got some little mini water wars of our own, I think, in New Zealand, which we have to face up to. And down in Canterbury, sure, the city is on this great clear water aquifer, but when you get a little further out into other parts of Canterbury, the levels of nitrate in the groundwater are creeping up to reasonably dangerous levels, and we haven't got a game plan for stopping this trend and turning it round. So I do foresee quite a few problems, not just for the farming community, but for city people as well, looking forward.
So this increase in nitrate levels, is this due to intensification of farming?
Absolutely it is, yep. And especially intensive irrigated dairying, which has become a huge thing in parts of the South Island over the last 20 years. And we sort of rushed into this, and we talked about white gold, you know, from the milk and all this kind of thing, but we didn't, I think, fully understand the implications that it was going to have for our water supplies and our streams. So Canterbury people are pretty upset because a lot of the streams that used to flow all the time are now running very, very low, down to a trickle in summer. The trickle is getting pretty polluted. And, you know, down here in Canterbury, where I'm just visiting this week, there's a lot of people who are pretty upset about this. I think that New Zealand as a whole has to take this issue a lot more seriously. If you look at the combined effect of water contamination and climate change, what it actually is all about is changing the way we earn a livelihood in the world. So for many years, we've relied on livestock farmers to bring in the foreign exchange that we need to buy our smartphones and our cars and everything. We've actually got to find a way of earning a living in the world that isn't so dependent on livestock farming. And that's the challenge in front of us. I think we are right up for that. I think we can change the structure of the economy, but we shouldn't have any illusions that we can just kind of patch up the existing farming system and carry on. We actually have to think about some major changes of land use, and we have to think about the kinds of new export industries that we could generate based in our cities that are not going to create water pollution and are not going to create greenhouse gas emissions. If you look at the rise of software export businesses like Xero, you're looking at the way of the future, I think, and it's an exciting thing, but somehow we have to stimulate more of it.
The Wire. I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
That was Professor Michael Young and New Zealand Ecologic Foundation spokesperson Guy Salmon. We'll be back shortly just after this break.
I am the auteur of my mind's eye. Huh? Our consciousness is only the second unit to our subconscious. Alfred Hitchcock didn't invent the dolly zoom. My soul invented the dolly zoom.
So you are keen to go to the film festival then?
The New Zealand International Film Festival is back for 2017. From July 20th to August 6th, the world's best movies at Auckland's best cinemas. For program schedule and tickets, go to nziff.co.nz.
Imagine a land where groove is the law. A place where rhythms run like waterfalls off the cliffs of funk, falling into bottomless pits of glee and ecstasy. One man ruled this glorious land for generations with impressive strength and a firm hand. And then he mysteriously disappeared, causing a darkness to fall upon the land for years to come. But light always follows darkness, or some shit like that.
The man himself is back. Murray Kamak has come back into your life to turn that frown upside down and keep the beats pumping till the early afternoon. It's Land of the Good Groove, every Friday at 1 p.m. on The Beat.
That was The Wire.
Yes, and that brings us to the end of another Thursday Wire. My name was Adam Jacobson. Joe Guy will be back next week. I'd like to give a big thanks to my two producers, Harry and Ruben, for helping out today. And a big thank you to all those who spoke with us. Andrew Little, Josephine Bartley, Clark Tomberson, Michael Young, and Guy Salmon. Stay tuned for the 1 to 4. Thanks for joining us.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.